Thank you for standing by. At this time, the call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect.
Okay. No. Jeff, I'll do a quick roll call.
Yes, please.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone on today's PPSC PDP on Thursday the 17th of December. We have Jeff Newman, Tatiana Kramsova, Alex Gakuru, Avery Doria, James Liddell, Alan Greenberg, Paul Diaz, David Maher. From staff, we have Glenn de Saint-Géry, Liz Gaster, Marika Koning, Margie Milam, and myself, Eve LaGruber-White. I do not have any apologies for today. Wolfram joined as well. And if you could just please remind everyone to state their names before speaking for transcript purposes. Thank you. Over to you, Jeff.
Thank you very much.
Just Wolf joining. Hello.
And Robin Gross.
Hi, Robin. Okay, so today is... I'm sorry, is someone else joined?
Robin.
Ah, okay.
Hi, this is...
Great, welcome. It's December 17th. This is the PDP work team call. I know it's a little bit later than usual, our usual hour, but there was a GNSO council call that actually was a marathon call that just ended about a half hour ago, so it was a three-hour call. And I was on the call as an observer to address questions on our request, which they didn't get to until about... 2 hours and 15 minutes into the call. So, to make a long story short, there was no, because of the number of people that dropped off during the call after the two-hour mark, there was no real quorum to hold a vote on our motion. But there was a clear sense those that were on the call. I'm sorry, it seems to be a lot of noise there. If someone can, I don't know who's making that, if just... put on mute, or it seems to be a general sense of those in the council that first, it is their role as the council to determine whether there should be face-to-face meetings of any of its working groups, including obviously this one. It's also the feeling of the council that they should be looking at those requests in light of budgets that are apportioned to it, so that they can make a determination of. You know, a big picture determination of all of the funds and potential face-to-face meetings on that particular budget item, so they can consider that in their role as, you know, being the administrator of the policy group. So that's one clear sense that came out. Another one, I will say that although there were some comments raised, there were very few discussions on the actual substance of the request. You know, the non-commercial representatives on the council did discuss. Or at least Wendy made a comment about pretty much the same comments that were made on this call last week about the way this face-to-face was set up. And so that was made during one comment, but essentially the bulk of that at least half hour on the subject was spent on the role of the GNSO Council trying to figure out how it interrelates with the budget. I guess long story short, it's a little too late, is that we're not going to move forward with a face-to-face meeting. That at this point, the people that were on the call, it was kind of split when they were asked their informal opinion as to whether they thought it was this group should get any funding for a face-to-face. So I think the next step that I'd like to explore is doing a either one or two-day conference call or at least partial day conference call sessions. I've also asked the, in their discussion about the GNSO Council's role of approving face-to-face meetings, I also asked whether they thought it was in their role to approve, for example, getting better web tools for this group so that we could, if we did these marathon calls, we could actually have a something better than Adobe, something more akin to a WebEx where we can actually in real time update documents and take notes and so everyone can see what's going on, basically to have a more productive or two more productive calls. So before I get into discussing that, Alex, Alan, you were on the call, and whoever else was on the call, it might just be you, Alan. Do you want to give any Wolf is on the call as well. So do you guys want to give any additional input as to what the council, what happened at the council meeting?
Well, the only other thing I think that was relevant is you said by the time a vote would have come up, there was no quorum, and that probably was true. There was at least one other statement made saying that they are not prepared, that their constituency is not prepared to discuss it or to vote on it at that point, and that was Mike from the business constituency. And typically that's enough for council to not make a decision. Mm. So that probably would have been invoked should the other problems not have happened.
Mm.
Right. Well,
Jeff, you have all speaking?
Yes, great.
Well, okay. So it's the result is as it is. There was no quorum, as Alan said. So what I see for the future is, and unhappily, so we are the existing working teams are lacking, you know, from the support which is going to happen in future. Because right now, as you have seen as well today, the council has moved on the motion about the toolkits and for support of the constituencies and working teams and so on. And there's something in. So if you read that, you know, there will be something, but it takes time until it will come up, because staff has now to prioritize together with the council the kind of tools, the kind of funds to allocate. And it depends also on the prioritization work, which is also in parallel going on council level. So it will take some time, you know, so I'm really not happy that we could not make an exception in our case for the PDP working team, but okay, that's the case.
Yeah, so and then I'll go to Alan in a second. The other thing that came up is, you know, I sent, I'm not a counselor, so I just made a request that, look, if the GNSO Council wants to step into this role of approving all similar requests, it's got to do so in a more efficient manner than only at meetings and only, you know, and then a constituency having the right to put off the vote. Because if that's the case, then you're talking about it would take at the very minimum 2 months to put in a request for a face-to-face and then having a decision on it. So I think that's not a very efficient, and it's not a way conducive to ever have face-to-face meetings or whatever the council decides is in its administrative purview. So I brought up about the two web tools and said that I would hope that the council would not feel it's in its purview. Let's say I made a request to staff to come up with or spend a little bit of money on a better web tool than Adobe or something that works better, that the council wouldn't then say, well, we have to vote on that. And then someone like Mike would say, well, then my constituency hasn't thought about it, so we have to put it off for another meeting. I mean, you could see how those would be really inefficient. So what Chuck is going to do, I asked Chuck to do, is put together an email on the, quote, sense of the council, that at least the members that were on, so that he could send it to the team, and we'd have some sort of formal or informal response to our request. Let me go to Alan and then Avery.
I found just a little bit further. I found a couple of things somewhat disturbing. One of them in the end was the council has never had access to explicitly to budgets and to make decisions on it. And I found, you know, this one a little bit presumptuous to suddenly say that council should be making these decisions in order to properly use the money that's been allocated to it, whereas, as you just implied, if we want to use money in the IT budget, that's fine. You know, that's something we have the discretion of doing and staff can doing. And I found that a little bit confusing, that I'm not sure I see the distinction between them. The second is the argument that this is a thin edge of the sword, and if this group were to be given a face-to-face meeting, then council would have to give face-to-face meetings to every PDP working group and every other working team. And I think the fact that there are funds allocated to this one puts it in a somewhat different position. And lastly, I was disturbed that nobody raised the issue that this whole project is a little bit unique in that there's no participants who really have a financial stake in it. In most PDP processes, there are at least some constituencies or some stakeholder groups that have money involved in the outcome. In this case, there is no involvement other than having ICANN work better. And nobody mentioned the fact that people are willing to donate, and their companies often are willing to donate their own time to go to this kind of meeting, which typically will far, far exceed the out-of-pocket costs that ICANN will have to put into it. And I thought that was a relevant issue that should have been brought up.
Yeah, I agree with that. The other one, and then I'll get to Avery. The other semi-disturbing thing was, you know, when Olga immediately raised her comment was, well, if the PDP work team gets money out of this budget or face-to-face, then the OSC team on whatever should, every work team should get allocated the same amount of money.
And we have to divide it equally.
And yeah, divide it equally. And I thought, you know, that's not that I'm against them having a face-to-face meeting, but I think that was just, I don't know how appropriate that comment was at that point in time. Let me go to Avery.
Okay, yeah, hi, thanks. I guess, obviously, I wasn't there, and I'll listen. But from the sound of it, what you really seem to be hearing is that this is a new council with a new role to manage things, and specifically a role to manage the policy process, and this is part of that policy process, so you could call it meta-policy, that, you know, that they should have a grip on, and they should. So, yeah, it is sort of frustrating being the first customer of that new process while they're still trying to figure out how to do it, but it sounds to me like they're trying to do the right thing because they can't take just one case as an out-of-band case because as soon as you do, you do have other cases. So you really do have to come up with a process. Now, for a face-to-face, it doesn't strike me as that strange or horrible that one would know 2 to 3 months beforehand that they were doing it. Again, this group probably did, and so on, but the change and transition and process is one of the things that's happening. So I guess from what I'm hearing, while the conversation perhaps did not go, you know, exactly as one would hope, and I don't think a council conversation ever goes as much as anyone hopes, it sounds like they're trying to do the right thing to me, which is think this thing through, you know, and such. And since we didn't have a consistent, yes, we all agree that it's needed, we all agree with the way it's been planned, we all have this, they didn't even have a group 100% consensus in terms of what was being requested. They had a mixed bag, which makes it all the more reasonable that you don't apply exceptional, extraordinary rules to enable it. It would surprise me if, you know, spending money on new tools wasn't somehow different because new tools is a license gotten for everybody. If they were to have WebEx licenses, and it would surprise me if ICANN didn't already have WebEx licenses, but it might be the case. Once they had a license, it's a larger purchase than that. So that might fall in a different category. That doesn't strike me as strange. If it was bought just for the GNSO, only to be used by the GNSO, and nobody else could have it, then certainly it would be a GNSO decision, just as a face-to-face meeting would only be for the GNSO. So I guess from what I'm hearing, it really doesn't surprise me. The one question I have on quorum, once they had the beginning of the meeting and they hit quorum, I assume they had quorum at the beginning of the meeting. If so, they had it for a vote even after 3 hours. People leaving doesn't mean they lose quorum, as I understand the rules that they're operating under. Yes, Mike's email to the list saying, I had to drop off, my battery died, but, you know, we're not ready to vote anyway, certainly would have been a different issue. But
yeah, I think so. I think just a couple points, and then I'll go to Alan. it went as I expected it to go. I wasn't really too frustrated with the meeting. I think one important point, Avery, is that you're right. You should know 2 to 3 months at least before a face-to-face meeting. But we're not talking about that now, right? Because we're talking about this being a gating item. So you're talking about having to know 6 months in advance because you got to get the approval of the council first to have the meeting, and then you got to do the logistics. You can't really do the logistics. I mean, you could talk about it, but you can't plan the logistics until you have the approval to do it, right? So you're talking about 5 or 6 months at a minimum knowing, and I'm not sure work teams or work groups are going to know that far in advance. So I take your point, but you got to consider that in the whole scheme of the big picture, the face-to-face. So, one point that staff did raise is that they did view the technology as something that was within their staff purview, and as you said, it would be applicable to more than just one situation. So they took an action item to go off and to look at some of these tools and to consider the issues. You know, it's not just the tool that would allow, let's say, real-time editing, but it's an issue of bandwidth. And actually, Alex, I know you're on the call. Maybe you're one of the best people to ask about this. Has there been a tool that you've used that you haven't had issues with where there's been real-time editing or things that you haven't had such a bad issue with bandwidth? I mean, you're probably the best person to ask.
Yes, I was about to comment on that. The tool that, first of all, I've been unable to connect with Adobe, the one that is currently in use, and for one that has served me well has been Illuminate, which we have been using in our non-commercial stakeholder group monthly meetings, and also I use it for the IGF meeting, remote participation with Bill Drake. So that has been a good one. Other than that, I am forced to always keep asking, can I comment on the phone, because I can't connect online with Adobe, so I do have a problem with that, and Illuminate has served me well. That's what I could comment.
Okay,
can
great.
I have a question?
Yes,
this is Marika. This is Marika.
Okay, Marika.
Alex, have you also used that for like live editing and working on documents? The Illuminate. I'm just trying to get some insight from people that have used different tools to try to figure out which ones actually use apart from just sharing documents, allow like live editing. Have you used it for that purpose as well?
I have not used it for that purpose, but since Robin is online, maybe she could comment what Brendan Cabis, maybe they might have used it for another purpose. Robin, you on call?
Yeah. We haven't used it for that, and I think it may have that capability. It's like an upgrade to the service that we could get. I'm not sure. Brendan is the one who really kind of manages the system for us. But I think it's possible to do editing on it, but it isn't something that we've done yet. So actually, Brendan would be the best person to talk about what Illuminate's technical capabilities are.
Okay, but I can look into that. I was just curious to know if anyone had used it for that purpose.
Okay. Alan?
Yeah, just a couple more things. One of the things I was surprised at is Denise made a statement early on that a face-to-face meeting could actually help reduce staff costs if we can bring this thing to closure a lot quicker. And no one picked up on that at all. I think that's what she meant by it. I agree with Jeff that the outcome wasn't different from what I expected based on the discussions ahead of time. What disturbed me more than the outcome was the tone of some of the comments made, which almost made it sound, no one said this, but almost made it sound as if, we think we're somewhat real special and we need special treatment. And I don't think the work that this group has put into this process warrants that kind of tone and attitude.
Well, for the record, Alan, I do view this group as special, so I'm kidding.
Well, indeed, but in the opposite way, too, to that tone.
So the good news is, so what we're going to do is we'll send around a doodle for dates. I would still like to do it that week that we had planned to do a face-to-face, to have a couple conference call sessions. One day for a few hours and then one another day for a few hours with this software. So we'll send around a doodle. I'm thinking that week because that week was really fits within a schedule of milestones that we had hoped to achieve. And also, I'm thinking that people sort of reserved a few of those days in their mind in case there was a face-to-face. So hopefully,
Jeff, given that we're not locked into travel, it may be wise to make it a little wider and go into the previous week also. In my particular case, that may make a difference. I'm not sure yet, but nevertheless, you know, since we're not doing travel, we could look at a little wider spread.
Yeah, I think
in the doodle.
I think that makes sense. Let me, Marika and Avra, you have a comment on this?
Yes.
Okay.
This is Marika. I have a question in relation to what kind of time slots, like, you know, thinking about putting the doodle together, what kind of duration can people spend on the phone? Also taking into account, of course, that we're, most of us are in different time zones. So are we looking at, you know, 2-hour slots, 3-hour slots, 4-hour slots, or should we
put
in a variation?
That's what I want to give a suggestion on.
Oh, okay, great.
Aubrey?
Yeah, I've been thinking about that, and I've done this kind of thing before. And one model that works, and this is what I meant when I said sort of a marathon teleconference, is you take a 2-day period, remembering if people traveled, they'd be jet lagged anyway, and they'd have spent 2 days, you know, one getting there and one leaving. So you're talking about an intense period where you say 2 days, it's a marathon, and we're doing it. And what you basically do is you do something like 3 hours on, 4, 5, 6, 7 hours off, 3 hours on, and keep just going through the clock. Everybody gets the inconvenient times, but you keep going. And if people sort of say, I am devoting these 2 days to that, I'm not doing my regular work any more than I do when I'm away, and it's a focus, and then you just figure out what the group's tolerance level is a 6-hour break long enough, you know, is a 5-hour break long enough, 2 marathoners or do it on a 4 to 5 hour break. But, you know, it may take an 8-hour break, but you keep going through it in that kind of cycle. Everybody ends up with a night session. Everybody ends up with a day session, and you keep working. It also gives you some intermediate time to think, to try and write something, to pull things around. So I'd actually like to suggest that if we're looking at a 2-day period, we look at it in the same way we were looking at everybody traveling somewhere. And then we're not picking doodle times. We're just saying we start at noon on Wednesday and we go 3 hours on, 6 hours off, 3 hours on, 6 hours off for 2 days.
Does anyone have any? James has got his hand raised. James.
Hi, Jeff. And I wanted to compliment Aubrey on that. That seems like a way to spread the pain quite a bit, as much as possible. But one of my concerns about the face-to-face was just the disruption that it would occur in terms of the doubling down of the volunteer commitment to travel to a face-to-face and then be out of, you know, out of communication for my company tasks for that period and then to be traveling again. And I think that from that perspective, this would almost be equivalent. So while I'm not necessarily saying that this is a bad method, I'm just wondering if a marathon meeting isn't just a different way of packaging the same problems that the concerns that were voiced originally.
One of the other things that would be helpful is to know what regions of the world people are going to be able to commit. So, for example, if you know we do have a few people from the Asia Pacific region on our team, but if they're not available on those days, I'm not sure we need to accommodate the Asia-Pacific time zone. So it would be interesting to know who would be available in general on those days. And maybe that's how we do the doodle, is to just block out full days and then decide how we structure the hours. So is there any other thoughts on that?
It's Liz, actually. I didn't put my hand up, though.
Oh, okay, Liz.
I think we should sort of maybe work on the times a little bit and see what would be optimal. Like, I kind of am thinking that some kind of hybrid of what Aubrey's suggesting might be really useful, where we spread it out over, you know, a couple of days or even more than that. I'm thinking about the STI in a sense. I mean, we had 4 calls 1 week, but they were all in the mornings, if that, you know, ends up being optimal, you know, the time zone issue. I want to make sure we address the time zone issue fairly, because I really see how that could be a killer for some people. And also, so I have that in mind, some kind of rotation that's fair on the time zone piece and gives everyone a chance to participate. And then the second thing is, if there's cleanup work for staff, like as we go, I want to allot some time for staff to do editing, you know, in like some of these off blocks of time as well as rest. So I wonder if we could just play with some options, like how would people feel about mornings for some, you know, slightly longer, or afternoons, or, you know, whatever it ends up being, but I suspect it ends up being early morning for me, at least, you know, mid to later in the day for others. But that kind of approach, sort of a hybrid of the two.
Well, I mean, again, I think it kind of depends. Like, if Liz Williams and I'm trying to remember who else is in the Asia-Pacific region that's in this group, if they want to participate, then, you know, we have to consider that time zone. If not, then we don't. So, I mean, I think...
Isn't Liz in the UK at the moment?
Is she?
I thought she was in the UK. Actually, when she responded to the doula on the face-to-face meeting, she said she actually preferred Brussels because she was coming from the UK. I mean, it might have changed since the Seoul meeting, but...
And I'm less focused on selecting a time now as much as acknowledging that I want to be sure that we do rotate time so that we can address, you know, make sure everyone can participate is my primary point.
Jeff, I also think in view of the fact that there will not be travel for the days prior to the previously envisaged face-to-face meeting, we could also consider having a 4-day so that in between we have longer breaks. And if we have to pull stuff like the way the staff are saying, we have to look for things around, like Avery also mentioned, we'd have more time to just try and look around, get more input, maybe if you have to consult, get more of the opinion. We can consider even a 4-day period and then have more calls. And that period, just a thought from here. And it's Alex, just for the transcript purpose. Thanks.
I think that's a really good suggestion. So I tell you what, rather than spend more time on this call on that, because we spent the whole last call talking about another meeting and to just move on with some substance, why don't I'll take on the responsibility with ICANN staff to propose a plan to the group, taking into account all these comments, and then we could just comment on the email on that plan. It's easier when you have some kind of straw man together.
Jeff.
Yes.
Jeff, if I can make a last point on this, because one thing the group might want to take into consideration as well, because we are relatively behind on the timeline that we set ourselves to come to closure by the Nairobi meeting, because, of course, a deadline is there, I think, of half February that we need to have a document out if we want to discuss it or put it out for public comment for the Nairobi meeting. So another thing to take into account, if we're not, you know, as we are behind on our set timeline, we're not going to have a face-to-face. Marathon meetings might compensate, but, you know, we don't know at this stage whether that will really get us to the end, you know, the end stage. Another thing might be to, you know, try to make it more intensive meeting, but still try to have then maybe face-to-face time in Nairobi for some of the critical issues. If we cannot, you know, get to closure on those in the calls, or if it becomes difficult to actually find appropriate times for everyone to participate for longer slots, that might be as well an alternative to consider, and you know, coming to terms with the fact as well that the timeline will slip, and you know, partly as well, it doesn't seem to be such a priority for the council, you know, to speed this up. So I guess they'll accept as well that the original timeline cannot be met as we initially foresaw.
Yeah. So there are a lot of considerations, and I think what's best is that Marika, let's work on. We'll present a plan to the group, and then they can take pot shots at it, or they can, you know, add to it, and that's probably the easiest way to do it. I will say that I'm not very comfortable yet with planning a long face-to-face meeting in Nairobi simply because I'm not sure how many people are going to be able to go. The question for ICANN staff, they're not eligible necessarily for funding, right, to go to the Nairobi meeting. So if they're not otherwise going. So let's take that offline and we'll discuss it and we'll present a plan to the group and then we can go from there. Okay, and the other interesting point I did want to it's kind of a transition is that the stage 3 report is now on the list or a draft, very early draft, preliminary draft, and I see Avri has commented on some of the pages already. An interesting part of it is there is one section that deals with face-to-face meetings in stage 3. So I encourage everyone as they're reading that section, there's not much in it right now, frankly, because we didn't really have so much experience with making the request. But perhaps this is our opportunity to get our own ideas in about a working group setting up a face-to-face or requesting one and maybe trying to get that as some sort of standardized process to put that into the draft 3 report. So we now have stages 1, 2, and 3 in a draft report that's out on the list. Avri is the first person, and that's today, that actually has commented on those, on any one of those 3 stages. And so that's really going to help us get further along in the work so we don't have to. There are a lot of open items, as Avri notes, and things that we say we got to get back to. It would be helpful to try to get back to some of those or get ideas on those prior to marathon sessions because it'll be much more productive. The other thing that was put out this week is a summary of the actual results from the stage 4 survey. There were 11 people that have filled out the survey, which is a little less than what we normally have, but still a fairly good indication and a fairly good cross-section of groups that responded. Again, just as a reminder, the survey is not anything formal. It's not something that's, you know, a measure of consensus, but is really just a tool so we can indicate some of the sentiments in the draft report. Any questions on that?
Jeff, this is James.
Yes, James.
Yeah, very quickly, and I'm just, maybe this question is better directed at Marika. I was using a track changes, and I'm not very far through the document, but would you prefer that comments are submitted offline or outside of the document and we keep that clean versus putting markup into the Word document, or what are your thoughts on that?
This is Marika. I would prefer track changes. I can integrate comments from others into one document, but I think it's easier to see what people are suggesting, and it's easier for me to edit that. So personally, I would prefer if people want to do it in track changes. But otherwise, like Avri has done, I'm happy as well then to incorporate those comments or suggestions into the document, which then will be visible as well using track changes. So I'm flexible, but if you do it in track changes, that would be great.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. So with that said, I'm not going to go over the survey for stage 4. I think the best time to go over it is after we finish answering all the parts of stage 4. What's also I sent around to just an FYI is I sent around proposed questions for stage 5, which is the last formal stage, but then we would still have the overarching issues. So with that said, I believe if right now on Adobe, if you have access to it, we have the stage 4 document. If you don't have access to Adobe and have access to the wiki, that document is also posted on the wiki. So if I remember correctly, and I'm trying to see if we finished off on stage 3. I know we did 3A. 3 was dealing with a delivery of recommendations to the board. So once the council approves it, the question is what gets delivered to the board. We had an extensive discussion on the different type of reports that go to the board now. One is a council report, which has certain requirements currently in the bylaws. as to what needs to be in that. And then there is a second report, which most of us have not seen, or I'm not sure if any of us have seen it other than ICANN staff, that is a confidential report that goes from the ICANN staff to the board. And to my knowledge, have never been disclosed. Maybe a question to ICANN staff. I think on the last call, two calls ago when we were talking about the subject, we had asked if there was any possibility to release any of those, at least to the group, so we could see the basic elements of what is in that report and try to make recommendations either to enhance the council report to the board to make sure it covers the stuff that's in the staff report, or so we can understand if there's any truly confidential items that are in there that we believe should at least be acknowledged. Because right now, only some of us know that there's a confidential report that goes to the board. Not everyone knows that. It's not written in any kind of documentation. It's not written in any kind of process. So with that said, has anyone on ICANN staff been able to raise this issue to those that are in the know?
Let me make three points. It's Liz. One is, I understand your point about not everybody knows that there is the second report, which is why I clarified on this list at least that there are two reports, so that everyone would know that, at least on this list. It's not intended to be a secret, and I appreciate your concern about it. The ingredients of, no, I don't have any success releasing either the template or any examples. And I think that's something, you just have to raise directly with the board.
I just need to announce I'm back on. I'm going to go on mute. It's Marilyn.
Hi, Marilyn. Thank you.
It's Liz again. The contents of the report are basically what I put in one email, which I have to find now, but it was, a summary of the issue and any documents that are relevant to the issue, a summary of the constituency and public views, and ICANN staff advice to the board. Those are the three primary things that are in these reports.
So if I can ask you a question on that, and so putting aside the third element, which is the ICANN staff view, sounds like the first two elements, couldn't that be taken directly from the council report? Because doesn't the final report... The final report plus the council deliberations on it, doesn't that have to include, or doesn't that usually include, like an executive summary and the constituency positions? Doesn't it seem like those two are at least an overlap? Or maybe you can help share with me the difference of what is in the staff items for those two versus what's in the council report.
There's not much difference, but I can't really comment. I think to the degree that comments can be concise and thorough in the public report, it should eliminate or minimize the need to duplicate that in any other report. So I share that view.
So to ask it another way, and please, anyone that's got a question, please.
Yes, I do, Jeff.
My hand's up.
Ah, sorry, I was not scrolled on that list. Okay, the list is so large.
You cannot cue me, Alex. Cue me.
Okay, so let me go to Alan, then Alex, and then Marika.
Yep. I've talked to a number of people about this in the last couple of weeks, and a number of things came up. First of all, it would appear that at least some board members are not aware that the report they get is private. Not that they're sharing it with anyone, but that they sort of just assumed that this was a document that has been seen by the people who worked on the PDP and by council and stuff. So there's certainly lack of clarity in that. I've also, the comment was also made is that although staff may have some confidential things that must be said to the board, staff's opinion in general of the recommendation should not be private. I mean, hopefully staff has the nerve to say this is a stupid idea and you shouldn't do it, without having to hide that behind a veil of privacy. And the last point is there seems to be a lack of clarity on who is insisting that these private these reports be private, other than parts that may be redacted for legal reasons. The statement has been made to me by board members that it's staff who insist on it, and staff, not staff people have said, but I've been told that various people say it's the board that insisted on it. So a little bit of clarity would be really nice.
Does anyone from ICANN staff want to comment on that, or should I just go to Alex?
I don't think I can add much more.
I mean, part of this may be in history that four boards ago insisted on it, and it's just been passed down from generation to generation.
Yeah, and I'm not discouraging, this is Liz again, that I'm not discouraging this group from raising any concerns with it that you think are appropriate.
Okay, let me go to Alex, and then I'll circle back to Marika.
Yes, my concern is that the stage four survey, the report was included as part of what we should recommend, whether it should remain, whether it should be scrapped, whether it should be modified, who should give it, etc. So my on a previous call, somebody said there's no point of ICANN waiting until things blow out. And now when you look at the openness and accountability under the affirmation, then there will be more accountability required by other people. So if this report is not discussed during work team, and we don't even know what we are recommending should be done, the issues that should be contained there should be discussed by the work teams, and we need to actually have clarity on this particular report so that the openness, we are trying to infuse more openness, I think it's done at this stage. So it should be important, I think, we are told what is in that report and why maybe it cannot be released and why we don't even know what it is, because I'm concerned that it then create a situation where after all work teams have done whatever work they have done in our policy, then staff could override all of that through a report that nobody even knows. And furthermore, like I said earlier, we are recommending on something that we don't know. That's my comment. Thanks.
Thank you, Alex. Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika. Actually, 2 points. First, more to Alex's point, because what we're actually commenting on in specifically in issue 3 is the report that's mentioned in the bylaws. And I know people want to talk about the staff report, but I think we should also focus on the council report and see how that should improve or can improve. And on a more general nature, just want to point out that I've tried to capture here some of the points that were made on the mailing list, because there was some discussion on that. And I would just like to encourage people as well, when they see the comments, you know, normally I put this document out before the call, so they review it and make sure that their comments have been reflected accurately, because this is as well the basis for developing the actual report and recommendations. So I just wanted to highlight that as well.
Okay, thanks, Marika. So what I'm hearing, at least from the people that have spoken up, and it'd be great if other people want to at least agree or disagree, even if it's just on this Adobe, what I'm hearing is, even putting aside the staff issues, the first point I think most people are making is that we believe as a work team that whatever report is sent to the board should always be made public, that there is a possible exception for legitimate privileged or things that should legitimately be confidential, but the rest of it, including the first two items that you referred to, should either be written by the work team or the council, or even be part of the council report. But that it seems like what I'm hearing is that there's really no need for the staff to duplicate that, and certainly if they do, that should certainly be made public. The next item on staff's opinion on the policy, it sounds like from a couple of the people that have made comments, and again, please agree, disagree, or raise your hand. It sounds like the work team is recommending or is saying that if the staff has issues with the work that's going on or the output, that should be made known to the working group or to the council at least prior to even the council voting on it, so that those items could in theory be addressed by the working group or at least the council before it ever gets to the board. So I think a couple people put a check mark to agree. I see James, you want to add or have a comment?
Yeah, Jeff, I agree with your summation of that. The only thing I have maybe some hesitation on is where, if staff has any concerns or opinions, what point that should come in, whether that should come in before a council vote or whether that should come in after a council vote before it's put to the board. And I haven't really played that out in my head yet. So other than that statement, I think that what you've said is something I support.
Well, Let me ask a question on that, since it's good to hear your kind of stream of conscious thinking of it. If it's after the council votes, then who would be responsible for addressing those concerns? So let's make up an example. So let's say it was a domain tasting issue and it hasn't been resolved, and so the council comes up with a report that says that all registries should be required to implement this. All registries that offer an AGP should be required to put this policy into effect. And let's say the staff had a question or a concern that says, well, they don't believe that they're going to be able to require registries to adopt this policy because it doesn't fit in with such policies, or they don't think they'll be able to get it into a contract. That's something that who could address that, or who should address that?
And I guess this is James again. I guess the issue I'm struggling with is, you know, if there is a genuine obstacle to implementation, you know, we want to give every opportunity to get that addressed so that perhaps that can be addressed before this policy is approved. However, we don't want necessarily those types of objections to affect decisions or the way the council votes. So that's what I'm struggling with right now, Joe.
Okay, I see that. Alan and then Aubrey.
And yep. then Marilyn, please.
Yep, then Marilyn. Alan, Aubrey.
Yep. We're wandering into an area that I've never heard discussed before, and I think it has a lot of merit to discuss it. In general, a policy staff who works with the GNSO and the GNSO work groups is really, really superb in that they typically act as support staff and not voice opinions of their own. And as the people who are facilitating creation of a bottom-up policy, that's really, really good. Often in discussions on PDP work groups, staff do make comments about implementability of things, and that's valid, and I think has a part, and we need to make sure that continues to happen. What doesn't happen right now is staff's opinion on whether this is a wise move, not whether it's implementable, but whether it's smart. And I think we need to put into the process an opportunity to explore that, because if the working group disagrees, the working group should have an opportunity to rebut it, and the working group may well change their position because of it. So I think staff, we need to give staff an opportunity to take off the support and facilitator hat and put on the hat they wear when advising the board, and have an opportunity for those opinions to be voiced. Because right now they don't happen unless they're out in the hallway very privately.
So that's a good point. And maybe let me address a question to, and I'm sorry, Marika and Liz, to put you guys on the spot. But is it general, when staff puts its opinion to the board, does it generally come from the policy staff, or does it generally come from others in ICANN that don't interact with the policy process, you know, like the lawyers, like the operations staff, or is it just there's no set formula, it could be from either?
This is Liz. Couple points. I think Alan's distinction is really important, this idea of implementation impact and assessing implementation impact versus, you know, advice on whether something's good to do. In recent years, the policy staff has begun to prepare staff implementation notes on PDP outcomes as they get close to being considered, and the timing is, you know, evolving, but say, you know, ideally before even the council considers it, where we assess implementation issues in consultation with the general counsel's office and the services staff and compliance staff and anyone else that would be involved in that implementation, and then raise those issues publicly in staff implementation notes. There hasn't been a lot of occasion for this, but we have done that because I remember doing it on Whois. But Alan's right about, you know, this other piece where we typically do not comment. So I think the staff implementation notes are an important contributor to this.
Well, let me ask. I'm sorry, Liz.
Go ahead.
Let me ask a question. You say typically you don't comment, but you're saying you don't comment to the working group or the council, but you do comment to the board or to others.
What
I wanted to make is that we, you know, these reports are not PDP specific. When the board considers issues, they ask staff to summarize the issue for them, regardless of whether it's a policy issue or not. So you're really focused on this in the context of a policy situation where, you know, it may not be appropriate for staff to have an opinion. But there are other issues that come before the board where, you know, any decision that the board makes. If you think about it that way, then, you know, it might give you a different construct for the kind of advice that staff would typically provide, say, on a, you know, on any other matter.
Okay. Let me jump to Avery and then to Marilyn.
Okay, thanks. I guess I would think that any advice, now I would make it global. I know this group is just going to deal with the policy issue, but I would make this a global statement, that any advice that staff was going to give to the board should be made publicly. I think when it's on a policy or some other work item, it just makes good sense for the staff to also have a way to give that before the decision is made so it can be factored in, as opposed to it being something that isn't factored in, and then, you know, when it goes to the board, it's, well, they didn't consider A, B, and C, or we think this is a really bad idea because of D and E, when those things have never been presented as ways that sort of works against getting work done. As I say, I think it would be a universal comment I'd make that, except for things about people, about contracts, about, you know, whatever that need to be kept confidential between a staff and its board, that anything that has to do with an open organization and its subgroups and its whatever should always have to be made publicly. It doesn't need to be approved by the group. You know, the stink test, the giggle test is good enough. If they put out something and immediately there's a lot of emails saying, but that's not the way it is, that's good enough vetting for it. But it does need to be made public.
So, Avery, let me ask you a question on that, and to kind of tie it to James's point, when should that be made public? So presumably, I'm sorry, go on.
You can qualify the question more before I answer it, sorry.
Well, I'm not sure I was going to qualify it well, but what I was going to say is presumably they could wait until after the whole council and deliberations is over and the vote is taking place and it's just before it's going to the board, or even if the board, you know, the board will oftentimes have a separate comment period, so maybe it's during that time period, but you're saying, that, at least to what I thought I heard, is that there should be some time for a public response to the staff's opinion as well? Did I hear that correctly? Or?
Yes. I mean, I think that makes sense. If we're trying to make sure that we're doing good work and that we're taking everything into account that needs to be taken into account, to have the notion that there would be a group of people either responsible for implementation or just responsible for the advising a board that would have issues that we weren't told and therefore couldn't deal with is kind of like waiting for a gotcha. It's sort of, there's a hole you're about to fall in, but we're not going to tell you it's there because we don't want to influence the way you're walking. And I think it's better for the group to be told about any issues that their recommendations face, and then they have the option to say, we don't care about that because of this. Oh, you're right, we should do more work on it. Or, no, we think this was handled in this way and that way, just like anyone in the public's comments. And so I think that's the wise way to do things, as opposed to doing it afterwards. The main proper answer to a comment that comes in afterwards that's substantive is for the board to send it back to the council or the group saying, hey, you know, staff had this issue that you didn't deal with. Deal with it. And so that's certainly another way to do it. But the council has to have a chance, the council or its groups has to have a chance to deal with every possible issue, comment, disagreement, whatever, that there may be on the work it's doing.
Okay. Let me go to Marilyn.
I've been a proponent for quite a long time that the reports that are sent to the board be made public. I'm probably more flexible on the timing of when those reports are made public, because my comment about the staff reports that go to the board is a broader comment that does include the GNSO Policy Council and policy work, but isn't limited to that. So I think just as a general practice, there should be rare instances when reports that go to the board that inform their decision-making are not made public. However, I would say that I do think it is appropriate for staff to be able to offer qualitative or quantitative analysis. Now, hopefully, that of the process. Hopefully that would be included in the public report, which is prepared from a working group that goes to the council. But I think we want to be careful about something, and I'm going to be very direct about what I want to raise. The staff need to be able to offer a qualitative or quantitative statement which and not be scapegoated about the position they put forward, or and be treated continually as professionals within the rest of the process. So we want to enhance transparency, but we want to do it in a way that we don't fall into here's a staff assessment about a particular area that has not been addressed fully in the report, and all of a sudden we get flame mail from, you know, a variety of people arguing about whether or not their assessment is accurate. So maybe we can figure out how to achieve all of those objectives and make, you know, ensure that there is a safe harbor when staff, not just the policy staff, by the way, the analysis might come from some other part of the staff about something that hasn't been taken into account by a working group, or new information that now needs to be taken into account, and we all know that that can result when you have a fatigue task force or a fatigue policy council in tensions. So how do we, A, support as much transparency as possible, but still enable the staff to make appropriate qualitative or quantitative comments and still make those public, but do it in a way that doesn't create unintended consequences?
Can I comment, Jeff?
Let me, is it on what Marilyn said? Or is it something?
No. Yes, it's on what she said.
Okay, yes.
Yes, I think that's a fantastic way of looking at it, and just to add on to a proposal to that, perhaps to avoid personalizing a comment or an opinion against a specific staff member, maybe the issues that are going on at any one time at a work team or the council, the staff could create a sort of a space where the issues that they think are relevant and need to be addressed can be raised there without while the work is going on. And this will now give the work team or the council or the relevant group a time to look at those issues, and then we can try to address them so that we don't have the mails she's talking about that are targeted or directed at a particular staff member. I think that is something we need to consider. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, thanks. Let me go to Aubrey's, your hand was up from before. Let me go to James and then Alan.
Hi, Jeff, this is James, and I've been getting pulled away periodically, so I apologize if this has already been covered since the last chat. But it sounds like we're starting to define a different animal here, which is something like a implementation statement. And I apologize if we've already gone over this, but the idea that accompanying the final report of any PDP working group that the staff would, without interjecting any opinions on the merits of the policy or the intrinsic value of pursuing it, should be able to put together a statement on whether or not they foresee any challenges or even, you know, obstacles that would mean it would not be implementable, and that could accompany the final report, the motion, and everything that's packaged up and sent to council. If that were defined and narrowed so that it didn't include any subjective assessment of the policy merits, I think that might be something we could design, as opposed to convoluting the process of there. And it might even obsolete the idea of a confidential report as well.
So on that implementation statement, though, just to kind of merge it with some comments, other comments that have been raised maybe when you were away, should the issues in the implementation statement that you referred to, shouldn't they be known by those that are deciding the policy prior to that point so that it doesn't come as a surprise to anyone? So in other words, if the board is able to use that implementation statement as a reason to deny the entire policy, then shouldn't that have been something that people have had the chance to comment on?
Just for clarification, I was saying that should go to the council, not to the board. And, then the council would certainly have the latitude to send it back to the working group until the implementation concerns are addressed.
Okay.
That's just a thought. You know, I'm trying to tiptoe around this without actually turning staff into a stakeholder group, which is kind of the course we're on. So, this is the hazards of, thinking off the cuff, which certainly we do a lot of in these groups.
Yeah, I know that's an interesting statement of not turning staff into a stakeholder group, but in essence, aren't they? I mean, if a policy is being designed and they expect staff to implement it, then staff should have, to defend them, they should have the right to voice their opinion. Not only should they have the right, they absolutely should do it. And I think what we're saying as a group is that they should do it at a time when the community can actually, they should A, make it publicly known, and B, do it at a time when others can respond to it. Let me go to Alan.
Yeah, I mean, what I originally said was staff have to be given an opportunity to put on the other hat, that is the advice hat and not the support staff hat. And Marilyn said it in a different way. The implementation report, although it may not be happening in a formal way, I see already happening, that in the PDP process there is interaction with the various implementation staff, and we do explore whether this is going to be able to be built if we recommend it. So I see that happening already. We may need to formalize it a little bit and perhaps require it. But I don't see that as the contentious part. I disagree with James. I want staff to tell us when they disagree. If they're going to give that report privately to the board or publicly to the board, we may as well have the benefit of it early and be able to consider it. The issue of staff being flamed, that is, they have their own private purposes and they're going to do things counter to the interests of the community, that's going to happen anyway. It does happen. Maybe what we need to do is have that staff advice, which is really likely a combination of policy advice and implementation advice, be given without a necessarily without a name on it. But the working group has the benefit of it. And I think the more I think of it, the more I think it's absolutely essential. And why didn't we ever think of this before?
Okay. Let me jump to Avery and then to Robin.
Actually, I think Marge may have had her hand up before me. So, you know, but...
Sorry.
Yeah.
That's a scrolling problem. Sorry. Thank you. Yeah, Margie, okay.
Yeah, I mean, on the topic of the ICANN opinion, I mean, I know there's this concern that we want, staff to be neutral on things, and I completely respect that. But staff, we are the employees of the organization and probably a perspective on how policy is done. And so there's things that are organizational that merit, you know, an opinion like budget or risk issues or legal issues. And I just want to caution because it might get to get the input on in an implementation report. You might, in other words, it might be hard to coordinate, for example, with the legal department to get their comments in time before the GNSO, evaluates it. I mean, certainly, I think it's a good idea to suggest that, I don't want to advise at that point.
Yeah, Margie, it was a little tough to hear you because you were breaking up a little bit, but I think the comment was that you're not sure that you can get all the comments in during the GNSO process. And that it's, sometimes complicated. But I guess the question for you and for staff is, shouldn't that still be made known and shouldn't people have time to comment on it? Right? And because right now we're all kind of guessing here because the only people that have seen these reports, frankly, are you, Liz, Marika, you're the only ones that have seen this report. We're kind of guessing in the wind here. And but let me go to Avery and then Robin.
Okay, hi, thanks. I actually do agree that I think it was with Alan, and I think perhaps Margie was saying something similar, that in a sense staff are stakeholders. That they have to live with it. They're part of the community, et cetera. And yes, they have a hard role because they have to most of the time be neutral, but they should get to state their viewpoints. I mean, they're intelligent people that care. And to say that the idea that comes from an intelligent person that cares who happens to be staff isn't worth having is problematic. On the other hand, at the moment, because they do that. They do give their viewpoints, but they give them only to the board, and they give them in secret, makes them almost beyond stakeholder or super stakeholder. And that's where I have a problem. I want to hear the views of the intelligent people that we work with all the time. Then on the issue between implementation and policy, that has shown itself in all engineering, let alone in ICANN, to be a fuzzy border. And we've seen with some of the implementations of policies that we're doing now that border is constantly being encroached. The GNSO may push on that border a little bit when it's making policy and kind of indicating how it might be done. And the implementation may sort of say, well, this policy doesn't quite work, but if I torque it slightly this way, I can make it work. And both sides there are sort of encroaching on that line. It's a fuzzy border. That's going to happen. So what makes it work is if, there's open knowledge and there's open dialogue, then the fuzziness of the border is less of a problem. As for getting flamed, no, they shouldn't get flamed. None of us should get flamed. We all get flamed sometimes. you know, and that's and you know, that's where we build a culture of tolerance where we learn to be flamed without taking it badly, and people stop flaming us because it doesn't get any reaction. But that's beside the point.
Okay, let me go to Robin, and then after Robin, I kind of want to cut off this topic, and we do, you know, Liz brought this up. We do need to talk about the council reports as well. So let me go to Robin, and then we'll go to the council.
Thanks, Jeff. Yeah, I just wanted to comment on the role of ICANN staff in providing advice to the board. I don't see it as being a stakeholder group in and of itself. It seems to me that it's part of the larger community that you know, and ICANN as an organization is here to facilitate the community and the various stakeholder groups within that community. So, you know, staff as employees of ICANN, the facilitator, are an important piece of this process, but I guess I don't see them as being a separate and distinct stakeholder group with its own interest, if you will. Now, certainly we got to have advice on implementation given to the board by staff. That's appropriate, but there's no reason why it should be confidential. I mean, if there's a particular reason that staff can come up with that ICANN should not undertake a particular public policy decision, then we should know what that reason is, and the public should have an opportunity to comment on that reason. I mean, you know, what is staff wrong in its analysis? I'm sure it's possible that at one point or another throughout the history of time, staff might be wrong in its analysis, and no one would know about it, and no one could correct that. No one could further develop that view or comment on that view. So it's really important that this advice be made public. It's important to not only to the community, but it's important to the goal of developing the best policy possible is having this policy developed in open where people can point to mistakes and correct them and further develop them. And that can't happen if it happens in an environment of secrecy.
Yeah, I think most people in this group, unless they hear otherwise, I think agree with that. That notion. And I will say, look, staff has, at least in the past, and even with the vertical integration issues report that just came out, certainly staff has expressed their opinion at that stage. What we're missing is staff expressing its opinion, at least publicly, after the issues report comes out. Now, a lot of us may not agree with what staff put into the issues report. You know, the vertical integrations report is an example that many I've heard take issue with, but at least they made it known, and at least now we have an opportunity, all of us as a community, to comment on it before it gets to a formal PDP. And so maybe it's that kind of opinion that we expect throughout the whole term of the PDP. Aubrey, is your hand newly raised, or is that left over? You might be on mute, so I'm going to assume it's left over.
Jeff, it's Alan. Just one very quick comment, that your comment on the vertical integration report is correct, and the tone in that report is quite different than one we've ever seen before, at least that I've ever seen before. And I wonder, is this a new direction or a one-off case?
Yeah, I think that's I don't want to get into that issue.
No.
But you are right in that staff certainly has expressed an opinion, and maybe what we're asking for as a group is that we know those opinions throughout the process of the PDP, whether we agree or not. At least we know those opinions and can respond to them, so that they're not just raised at the last minute and they're sent to the board, and nobody ever knows what they are, and nobody has a chance to respond to those. So,
So
Liz brought up a good point early on. She said, "Look, this is only the." Board report, the confidential report, now confidential report that we're talking about, but there are some requirements, at least in the current bylaws, on the council report. So the one thing I want to make sure is that we agree that those elements that are currently in the bylaws for the council report are still the right elements, whether or not they're in the bylaws or an operations document or something else. Are these the right elements? So right now we have the first element is a clear statement of any successful GNFO vote recommendation of the council. Does anyone disagree? Alan, is it new comment?
No, I'll let you finish first.
Oh, So the current requirements are a clear statement of essentially the vote of the council. If there was a successful vote, and again, that depends on whether something was in or out of scope, but we won't differentiate here. If there's a successful vote, they want a clear statement of positions held by council members. Each statement should clearly indicate the reasons underlying each position, the constituencies or stakeholder groups that hold the position, an analysis of how the issue would affect each constituency or stakeholder group, including financial impact, the analysis of the period of time that would be likely to implement the policy, and advice of any outside advisors relied upon, including some background on the advisors. And I'm paraphrasing here. Obviously, the final report would be attached to it and a copy of the minutes of the council deliberation on the issue. So and I'll turn to Alan. Are these the right elements? Should there be additional elements? Should we change these? Let me go to Alan.
Well, I'll just make an observation. As you were reading them, and I was thinking about them perhaps ahead of your words, I suspect some of those requirements which are in the bylaws are what makes our reports large and unwieldy and neat, and that staff need to summarize before they go to the board. You can't include all that level of detail and the impact on each constituency or stakeholder group and the financial impact without starting to make this a long document and to some extent out of control of the working group itself, since they're almost effectively minority statements, not minority statements, but statements of those groups, without making it a report which is not concise and to the point. So those very requirements may be part of what requires staff to summarize things. Now, whether it's secret or not is a different matter, but I just question that of maybe we need to do a level set by talking to the board as to what the board really wants to hear and read from us.
I think that's a good point. I think, as I was reading through it, I had some thoughts of, hey, doesn't Part C sound like what the staff is doing again in their report? In other words, in C it says it's an analysis of how each issue would affect each constituency or stakeholder group, including financial impact, that it almost sounded like when Liz was going through some of the elements, that was one of the elements that staff puts in its report. So I hear what you're saying. Let me go to James and Aubrey. James?
Hi, Jeff. Thanks. This is James. And I just wanted to mention something. I'm still taking in all of these different points, but this is the second time in this call, and I think multiple times in the course of this group, that I wanted to address the concept in the laid out in item C, whether or not there's a financial impact on constituencies. There's always going to be a financial impact, I think. Some may be more direct than others. Some may be a little more convoluted, and I think that sometimes you certainly don't want to put a PDP working group or staff or the GNSO into a position where they're choosing between the relative merits of different financial impacts. And I think that, there's this tendency to say that, if something is driven by a financial interest, that is somehow, infused with some sort of a self-serving nature. When in fact, I think that contracted parties are looking out for the financial interests of their customers, in many respects. So I think that, it's important that we have them out there and on the table. I'm sorry, there's some noise there. It's important that we disclose them and they're out there, but I certainly don't want them to be used in any way to diminish or discount the views that are put forward by those folks who are, more engaged in the commercial aspects of a given policy. So I just wanted to get that out there.
Yeah, and I think it's a good point. And something that occurred to me while you were talking is, shouldn't all this stuff be in the final report of the working group as opposed to being in the council report to the board? In other words, kind of merging your comment with Alan's, if this was the information in the final report, then perhaps just a summary of some of this stuff would be in the council report to the board, which would make it shorter.
Right. And I agree with that, and I also wanted to point out that, reemphasize that there's always a financial impact. And if we are saying that we want to eliminate or make a change in a policy that eliminates one financial impact, what we don't realize is we're probably creating another one, unanticipated financial impact down the road. So it's really just moving that impact around as opposed to attempting to work around it or eliminate it or control for it. So just wanted to get that into the conversation.
And possibly, James, that could be right now it says financial impact on the constituency or stakeholder group, and what you're trying to say is it could be on the group, but it could also be on those that the group represents as opposed to the group itself. In other words, if it may not be a financial impact on registrars, but it may be a financial impact on their customers.
Certainly. Certainly, or the users, or just, you know, the internet community in general. There's no way to disentangle those concerns from what we're doing.
So let me,
from any stakeholder group.
Right. So let me go to Aubrey, and then also with the notion of maybe these are elements that are more appropriate in the final report, and maybe we don't, right? Because right now we're putting the council in a position of creating all this stuff, when in theory they're supposed to be the managers of the policy under this new structure, as opposed to the people writing the new policy. Well, let me go to Aubrey.
Thanks, Aubrey. I think it's important that this information all be collected, all be available to the board. Does not need to be collected twice in two different reports. It probably makes sense that it is collected as part of what the council considers in whether full and proper process and whether it has been a well-formed policy development process, which is the decision it has to make at the end of the day. I think the financial relevance and the financial impact is critical. I think it's right to say that there's always a financial impact on everyone, but the financial impact varies on who it impacts and how it impacts them. So it's very good to have an analysis that in one case the financial impact is beneficial here and it's detrimental there, or it's neutral across the board, or various statements. So certainly both a detailed financial impact per constituency, per stakeholder group makes sense. A financial impact to the overall, to the registrant, to the whatever, also makes sense. So I think this information all has to be there. I think the board has to have all of it available to them. Obviously, some in the board will always be the types that only read the two-page executive summary, and that's it. There will also always be those on the board who either they or some staffer of theirs pours through the whole thing and gets down into the nitty-gritty details that they need to make their decision. So I think we have to give the board both a accurate, relevant executive summary that gives a good snapshot of what's there, but then a very detailed collection of information that allows the nitpicker to pick nits.
Jeff, this is James. Can I respond to one part of what Aubrey was mentioning?
Robin, did you have something different, or do you want to respond also?
Well, I'm not sure. Actually, this is the right moment to raise this issue, but it's on this issue of including financial impacts and what kind of impacts to include in this report to the board. And I just wanted to say that I think we need to broaden the way we think about it to being more than just financial impacts that are something that we think about as a general process, particularly from the perspective of non-commercial users. Oftentimes, it's not the financial thing that brings us to the table. And so the impact there might not be the important piece for us. Maybe the impact on civil liberties, or the impact on access to information, or impact on these other sorts of goals are the important piece for us. as opposed to a financial impact. So I would just like to broaden what we include, what we ask for from stakeholder groups to be more than just financial impacts, but can be broader than that and can include these other types of impacts that a particular policy could have upon the stakeholder group.
Yeah, and I take your point. The statement does say an analysis of how each issue would affect each constituency or stakeholder group, and it says including any financial impact. But maybe it's an including but not limited to financial and other.
Exactly, financial and other. You know, it's just I just think we need to think more broadly than. I mean, I think it's fine that we sort of focus attention there on financial, but it's not the only. Particularly from our perspective, it's not the only issue that brings us to the table. And so if we can, you know, just have some kind of recognition that it's not the only impact that we need to think about. And it isn't currently worded that way, but it just, you know, if we could just be more welcoming and including other impacts.
I could have comment on the same, Jeff.
Let me go to James, and then I'll go back to you, and then we actually have to wrap up the call because I know a couple – people have to jump on to other calls. So let me go to James, and then I'll come back to you.
Okay, and I'll just get this out, and then you can go back through the queue. But just I think it's we're opening up a little bit of can of worms when we talk about determining which of two competing financial impacts are acceptable. You know, certainly there could be cases where one would see a dramatic decrease in ICANN revenue to the benefit of registries, registrars, and registrants. I mean, you know, those types of decisions, I think the information should be out there and the community could be left to make those determinations on their own. But I get a little concerned when we start interjecting opinions into that financial impact analysis. So I'll just leave it at that. Thanks.
Thanks, James. Okay. And I believe that was Wolf that had a comment.
It was Alex.
Oh, I'm sorry. I got to learn voices better. Alex. Yes.
Yes. Okay, Alex, yeah, I've mentioned for my name again. Now, the contribution I want to make to this is that if, for example, the policy that had to do with the pricing of the new GTLDs right now is, let's say, $1 million or whatever it is, when you look, maybe if I speak from the African point of view, the financial impact of even $100,000 is not the same from our view as maybe the registries who are up in the developed countries. So you find the impact, if we didn't have access to the financial impact of such a report, then I think we are not able to offer more input into maybe the policy as towards the price of the of domain. That's just an example I was giving. So I'm just underscoring the importance of having this information in advance so that we are also making more informed contribution into the discussion on any PDP that may affect us financially in a different section of the world, if you like, of the community. Thank you.
Hey, thanks, Alex. Any other comments on the council report? So one of the things that I think we need to take note of as we wrap up this call is that it seems like these elements, as we've talked about, these elements really appropriately belong in the final report even before it gets to the council, and that maybe these elements aren't necessarily the elements for the council report to the board, that they should have already been taken into consideration. Possibly, we haven't explored this, but possibly a summary of that, of some of those things, go to the board. But I take it, I can't remember who made the suggestion, and I'm trying to figure out how we go about doing this. But someone had said that possibly we should solicit the input on the board to see what it wants. And I think that's a very good question, and maybe we draft something to the board governance committee and say, hey, we're exploring this part right now, and we'd like to hear from the board what elements it thinks it needs to make an appropriate determination. So I will go offline. I will talk to Margie, Marika, and Liz and figure out the best way of getting that kind of – well, Marika's got a hand raised. So, Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika. Just before wrapping up the call, I just want to know if we can as well confirm the next meeting, which I presume is in the new year. Is it
Are we meeting the first Thursday, which I think is the 7th at the usual time?
Yes. I'm sorry. I should have mentioned that at the beginning. Yes. The next meeting, obviously, because of the holidays, would be the 7th of January at the regularly...
Yeah.
Actually, you know what?
UPC.
You know what? We're going to have to move that because that's the day of the consultation that ICANN is doing in D.C. on the registry agreements.
Oh, and it might be challenging as well because that evening there's as well a UNISO council call that same day. So
right.
We can try to find another time that week, or do we just do it a week later?
I'd like to do it that week. So let's send out a doodle for that week,
okay.
For either the 4th, 5th, 6th, or 8th, and see
okay.
what time works. Okay?
In the
meantime, you and I and Margie and Liz will converge and figure out a way to get some of this question to the board to see what they would like to see in a report.
Okay.
Okay? I wish everyone happy holidays, if they're not already in the middle of it. Certainly, and a happy new year to everyone. It's been a pleasure working with you guys this year, and I'm sure it'll be just as much of a pleasure in 2010.
Thank you, Jeff. Same to you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks, Jeff.
Okay. Bye.